The world is changing at breathtaking speeds, with trends and fads popping up and passing away at breakneck pace. Against that backdrop of nearly constant upheaval, we welcome you to the Sunday Scotch Society. Over delectable, sumptuous scotches and with the occasional good cigar in hand, we have open, honest, and uninhibited conversation about whatever strikes our fancy. Whether it's the critical issue of the day or a deep dive down the rabbit hole, we take it all seriously while having a good time. Join us for a stiff drink and a great conversation.
Good afternoon, dear listener. It is my pleasure today to begin the show with the permission of my dearest co-founder. I am, as always, Matthew B. Kelly, sitting here with you on this Sunday to have a great conversation and maybe a little tipple. So I'm sure Quincy will introduce us to that particular guest. But before we get to that guest, I'd like to introduce our human guest. Our guest today is an educator of over 15 years. What they are currently up to, I think I will leave to the conversation to reveal. She is, however, one of those higher ups in her institution of education. This will mark the first episode of a series which will be non-sequential on education. And I thought it very interesting to begin here because our guest today, Charlene Hansen, has a little bit of a different perspective from the average teacher. You guys can come at me for using average versus other terms, as we discussed in previous episodes. But we're one to randomly sample the population of teachers. I don't think she's gonna come up as, you know, the type of teacher that you would normally encounter. Is that fair to say, Quincy? I think that's fair to say. And not in a derogatory sort of way to any of the other teachers out there. It's just that she's doing something that, in my view, is a little bit different. And different in a way that makes the landscape of education far more interesting. I think that different types of schools, different types of schooling is something that we need to explore more in the country. And so with the caveat that it is our intention to have a conversation centered on education, but these things go where they want to go, I will say, Quincy, how are you today?
Wow. Okay. So good, good day, as Matthew would normally say. Good day to you, sir. I am incredibly well. I'm also very excited about this conversation. I have a line of questioning for our guest based on my own very, very, very brief sojourn through the education instruction infrastructure. Not here. I didn't teach here. I taught in Oklahoma and some other places. But one of the things that I find fascinating, and I want to get into this with Charlene, is education as a business. It's a very sort of tricky thing because it's like a church, right? A church has a spiritual responsibility, but it also has some business-like traits. People bring their tithes and offerings to the church so that the church can carry out its duties in the society and hopefully also provide some kind of living for the pastor or whatever the case may be. But its main responsibility is not as a money earner, but that is a necessity for it to be able to continue to fulfill its function. So I kind of feel like education is like that. It's not a money-earning entity at its heart, but it has to be profitable if it's going to be sustainable. Some people see it differently. I know some people who started schools purely as a profit motive, and that, you know, God bless them, and I wish them every success. But that's one of the things I want to get into with Charlene today. I'm excited about that. Before we do that, though, and Matthew, forgive me for saying this, but I think I'm going to really take a backseat and let you start the show for the next little while. That was very enjoyable. I almost wanted to put on some Barry White music, you know, because the tone was just so very sexy. and I'm not sure, you know, that that's the right tone for the Sunday Scotch Society, but it was a fun tone nonetheless. So let's just keep it going. The Sunday Scotch Society, Charlene, it, just so you know, did she say anything yet, aside from laughing?
No.
Welcome to the Sunday Scotch Society.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You're most welcome. I already said that. I told you welcome to the Sunday Scotch Society. You are an educator. This comes with some expectations from the society. However, you are also a guest on the Sunday Scotch Society. And so you may bear witness at this moment to that which gives us our name and that which gives us our, how does one say, Matthew, our je ne sais quoi, or whatever you want to call that. Today's tipple for the dipsomaniacs among us is the Compass Point Peat Monster. Now, the Peat Monster, Compass Box Peat Monster, thank you. The Peat Monster is a blended scotch, as all of the Compass Box scotches are, and it is sort of created with one idea in mind, and that idea is to be a major expression of the smoky earthiness that peat brings to the single malt and blended scotches that sort of litter the lowlands and other places that make peated scotch. It's not really a highland kind of a scotch thing. You don't find a lot of peat in the glens like Glenmorangie and Glenfiddich and whatever. But the lowland scotches are all about the management of that earthiness and that smokiness from peat. And so the Peat Monster is sort of a hymn to the peat tradition in scotch making. So I'm excited about watching Matthew, who has a very particular way of sampling the nose of these scotches. I'm very interested in watching him go through this one. And Charlene, of course, you're welcome to join us as we sample this tipple. This, Matthew.
You're also welcome to abstain. That is.
Is she? Completely. I don't know. I mean, it's. Well, okay, fine. She's welcome to abstain. Yes.
I'll hold off. Go for it.
All right. Thank
you. Ooh, that is quite alcohol forward.
Of course.
More so than our recent samplings.
Mm-hmm.
But it is also quite peaty, I would say, bordering on woody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Quincy, honestly, I'm a little afraid. It by no means carries quite the turpentine bitter notes of varnish, but it reminds me of it. So I'm not sure what to expect here.
Well, good.
It is named the Peat Monster, but
if you're not sure what to expect, then that's a part of the fun of the tasting. For me, in addition to the smoky earthiness of the peat, and to be clear, you know, the peat is that soil that it is, when you're making these alcohols, these liquors, it's all about the water, right? The spring water or wherever you get the water from. And so it isn't as if they put dirt in the scotch. It is that the water that they make the scotch with has peat banks, and it's in a not quite a peat bog, but there is that very wet dirt sort of atmosphere around it, and so that infuses the water that is giving off that aroma
for
in
sure
the scotch.
But is also the burning of the peat that stops the what is it? Is it the barley I'm being stared down. I'm like here.
Not at all. I'm enjoying.
I'm being curious, which I think is something that
exactly
should be strive for in education.
Precisely. But, I'm enjoying this. This is not I'm not staring you down. I'm just waiting for the next thing to come out of your mouth. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listen. I'm going to go straight to the taste
so that we can get it in the middle of it.
So that we can get to the conversation here.
All right, whatever. He just abandoned his explanation.
Quincy 1, Matthew 0 for the episode.
Well, what is it?
For those keeping score.
How are we scoring? How did I win? What did I win? Anyway.
This is an ongoing thing with us here. So,
While you're tasting, for me, like I say, in addition to the peat, I do get a little bit of that sort of not quite sharp citrus, but a little citrus in there, and some candy as well. So that's the thing about the peated scotches, is that if you like that smoky flavor, then you know something like the Peat Monster, where they turn the smokiness up, would be good. But if you don't like that smoky flavor, then, you know, it might be problematic. So Matthew's face is...
I can definitely see.
This is a picture worth a thousand words, this face. Right.
This is an acquired taste. Quincy, I'm going to have to say that I have not yet acquired it. But I can see it's something that one could grow into. I'm not quite there yet, I don't think.
Oh, yeah.
These are...
Oh, yeah.
Had I have been otherwise tempted, the turpentine smell emanating from your cups and the look on Matthew's face, that kind of
I don't know if
solidified
this is the one for you.
I'm not a scotch drinker at the best of times, so
this,
I don't know.
And the Peat Monster is not a scotch for everybody. they tell you that by calling it the Peat Monster.
Yeah,
you know, it's...
Not bad by any means.
I will say that the label is phenomenal. It's a terrifying looking monster with a circular row of teeth and big bulging eyes with many tentacles coming out of its head.
Which I would say is rather accurate imagery.
I don't know if that's what if you drink the whole bottle, that's what you'll feel like afterwards, maybe?
Possibly.
A whole bottle of any scotch.
I'll be impressed if you could get through that glass based on the look.
What is that? One finger, maybe a finger and a half? A
finger and a half, maybe. I've had two sips. I'm going to be on cruise control on this one.
Right. Well, fair enough. That's fair enough.
So you have a line of questions.
I do, absolutely.
And I want you to get into that really quickly. But to begin, I have two framing questions that I
fair
want.
Enough.
And I just let you guys rip. I realize that Charlene has spoken about six words so far.
Yes. I think that's more by her choice than the fact that neither of us will shut up.
Well, we'll see. Yeah, I'm sure we have our own little biases to protect our egos in that regard. So I don't know yet. But let me just ask. One sensible question. Open-ended. What do you think the qualities that you should cultivate in education are? And I don't want to say just for kids, because in my view, education should be ongoing. And then there may be people who didn't have the privilege of even a primary education, but they come to opportunities later in life to learn. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in that. And then the second question I have, a little more frivolous, but speaking about school as a business, and Quincy mentioned the church. Do parents pay 10% of their incomes for their children's education?
Well, to speak to the you said the skills, or what people should
What do you think you should really be cultivating in someone who's...
Can I ask before you answer, Charlene?
Yes.
I really don't understand that question. If you may, and if you do, it's probably a very good sign.
I was just going to interpret it in my own way, but you can feel free to ask for clarity.
Would you clarify?
I have been duly chastised, dear listener. I am trying to break it down in my own brain a little further. I think what I'm asking is, are there particular qualities that besides specific knowledge, like, okay, this is how you multiply, this is English syntax, yada, yada. Okay. Are there qualities that should be cultivated in someone regarding education, such as curiosity? I don't want to lead too much with the question, but that's what I'm getting towards.
Soft skills are... That is extremely important. And one of the things that I've done in my career is I really try hard to foster relationships with students and kind of create more of a coaching and mentorship role in a way. Because let's face it, reading, writing, arithmetic, you know, the three R's, yeah. Right? We're living in the 21st century where access to knowledge is at our fingertips. I mean, anybody can learn anything anytime online. There's a plethora of information out there. But it's how to get students engaged and interested in learning. And it's about connecting the dots with respect to, you know, why it's relevant and things like that. And interestingly, you know, of course, everybody's probably had this question from back when we were all in school too. When is this ever going to be relevant in my real life, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's about explaining to kids, you know, you may never use this in real life, but in the same way, you know, for instance, we have a lot of athletes at my school. So we'll say, you know, if you're out on the baseball field and coach asks you to do push-ups, right, or something like that, are you going to say, oh, well, we won't use this in a real game? No, because it's strength training so that you can improve in other areas, right? So you explain that even though you may not use a particular math skill or something in real life, quote unquote, you are doing the heavy lifting now so that you're improving your critical thinking skills. You're being able to actually think for yourself. You're able to think outside of the box, and you're practicing just those skills that you'll need when you do become challenged with a difficult problem. So yeah, soft skills. Curiosity, actually, it's interesting that you said curiosity as your quality, because in the past 10 years, I have been finding that's the single greatest challenge in education. Maybe not single greatest, let me qualify that. But I've noticed a decline in children's curiosity.
Really?
It sounds strange, but when we were kids, we would have to kind of ponder on something for a while. Like, why do we hiccup? You know, where does that come from? And we would kind of think about it. We'd talk to people about it. And, you know, we might not be able to get to a library to find the answer right away. Now, people have a question. If they want to know, they just Google it in 2 seconds. Nobody's really pondering on anything. There's no big questions. There's no
that's actually
curiosity.
Really, really powerful to me. I did not make the connection that accessibility of information may impact curiosity in that way.
I literally just this past week had a conversation with some ninth grade students about how their own creativity is. Like, some of them just don't feel as though they're as creative to come up with ideas. Mm-hmm. And something that I've, again, noticed over the past decade is that, for instance, little kids, when they play, oftentimes now, because they're so kind of raised by the iPad and television, etc., when they play, they're acting out shows or things they've already seen more so than just coming up with scenarios based on their own imagination. Or they get a box of Lego and they build whatever is on the box.
Right.
And then they don't want to touch it. It goes on a shelf as a display. Mm. They don't just take it apart and turn it into something else. Like, everything seems very stock. And, you know, oh no, we can't change this. This is how it says it. How it says to do it on the box, and that has been going on for a while, to the point now where kids don't seem to have that natural, like, let me just go spend an hour outside poking at things with a stick and, like, looking at random things. They don't have that natural curiosity to the same extent. And that's obviously a generalization, but that's a lot of children nowadays are like that.
Okay, so Matthew sort of hinted at you being a big shot at one of these education institutions, but you really haven't told us
I would be
remiss in not sort of forcing that statement now so that we don't have to, like, circle back to it out of context later.
Okay, fair enough. I've never been called a big shot before, for one. But I've also never been, you know, to circle back to the intro, I've never had anybody have to qualify that I'm the human guest on a show either.
That is simply just how much Quincy loves his scotch. They are guests on the show.
Oh, okay. But
he's not wrong. Yeah, he's not wrong. Yeah.
But I am the director of Boost Academy. We are a boutique school in the Palmdale area. We're on Palmdale Avenue. And we're now in our 7th year, actually. But we started as Boost Educational Services and then kind of organically grew into Boost Academy. Mm-hmm. And, we're really just a school that focuses on individualized pathways and forming those connections, building those relationships with students, and making sure that they're receiving the type of education that they need for what they plan to do in the future.
Cool.
So that's it in a nutshell.
Individualized education pathways. Sounds. I taught for a year and a half at a Montessori school. In Tulsa, and I was the music specialist. And your language reminds me a lot of the Montessori language, the sort of the student-directed, almost educational experience. Which is not to say that there's not a curriculum per se, but the idea is that whatever the students' interest is, it should be the more important thing in providing the educational experience. That was juxtaposed immediately against teaching at Tulsa Central High School, which was a magnet music school in Tulsa, where the curriculum was God and his angels. And any deviation from the curriculum was the devil and his demons. And I often found myself being me on the side of the devils, because you can't learn music really from a curriculum. You can provide places for students to experiment, places for students to explore, but music is learned in experience, right? I don't know what your education philosophy is. She called it a boutique school, which we're going to come back to. But what I wrote down after listening to you describe your experience over the last decade is that you seem to be saying, in large part, there's, number one, there's no big questions anymore, and that imagination seems to have been neutered by the digital age, the data age, the big tech age, whatever the case may be, whatever you want to call it. First of all, is that true? Did I read that accurately?
No, that's accurate. But those are some things that we're trying to combat. Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to come off as doom and gloom.
No, not at all.
But in fact, those are some areas that I'm trying to focus on building up in our students, mm-hmm. to where we can actually reignite those passions and reignite that passion for learning.
I didn't mean to suggest it came off as doom and gloom. I'm just saying that's what I wrote down. Matthew, as a tech fan, will have his own views, and I trust him to express them at some point when I shut up. But I'm curious about, let's say that those are the cons. Are there any pros in your 10, 15-year experience as a teacher, you know, hands-on interacting with these children and young adults? Are there any pros that you've discovered, mm-hmm. that the tech age has afforded the students?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, it's a double-edged sword, mm-hmm. technology, because mm-hmm. they have access to every bit of information that they need, which is great, because anything that they want to know, they can really delve into and find out as much information as they want to. Mm-hmm. It's just that they need to also make sure that they're being exposed to enough different topics to gain interest in different things, because I find that people are getting very insular in their niche interests as well.
Yeah, they call it the T, right? Where there's broad knowledge on one, you know, kind of surface level knowledge, but then you go really deep on one specific thing. Right?
Yes, exactly. So we want to make sure that kids are still getting, you know, just general exposure to a lot of topics. Because you have kids who will take an interest in a very particular type of novel or a television show or whatever, and they only want to focus on that. So you still need to make sure you're putting out lots of different topics. But
I want to sort of scratch at that a little bit. Mm-hmm. How is that a pro? How is that a positive or a plus?
So because you can basically say, okay, well, you're interested in learning more about amphibians. Okay, well, I'm not an expert in that, but here's a great website that you can go look this up. You know, whatever the case may be. If you have a child who has a niche interest in something that we don't offer as a course at the school, we can find that course available online. So, just access to information is definitely a pro to me. And then they tend to be very on the ball with learning new things on the computer as well. So, so that part is good.
Does them tending to be really quick on the uptake in terms of gaining new skills on a computer, does it translate outside of the computer? Are they quick to pick up new skills elsewhere?
In some instances, yes.
Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't really call that an advantage of the tech age.
It's hard to pinpoint it on the tech age, mm-hmm. I guess. Yes.
Okay. I'm just curious. Yeah.
Maybe it's not the type of advantage you were looking for, but from my point of view...
Yeah, I wasn't looking for anything in particular. I was just asking. Yeah.
The fact that kids' neural makeup and the way they develop means that they can be very fast on these devices is a plus in itself, because it may not be something that the technology itself is bringing, but it is fitting into a niche where children can exploit. Perhaps I can alleviate your confusion by drawing the analog of children can learn languages much earlier. I mean, much more easily than adults, right? This neuroplasticity that they have, which is much higher than adults, means that these devices make them faster at what they want to do. Sometimes. But let me step back to that. The need to expose them to a bunch of different things as well, right? That, and technology's tendency to help them, not in a good way, but help them be
maybe more narrow their focus.
Yeah, I don't want to use the word focus because, like, it's tunnel vision, right? And you don't want that to be sort of extrapolated across their entire learning experience to be too tunnel vision.
Look, okay.
Like, to me, focus, the difference with focus is you turn it on and off, right?
Is tunnel vision bad, right? This is my question. When you have a child learning the cello will often have other interests to begin with, but then they play their first Bach suite. They probably start with the G major. And they get all the way through, and they're vibrating at the end because they played the entire G major Bach cello suite and they got through it. And then now they're like, okay, so now I got to get the E flat major one, and now I got to do the C minor one. And they continue to follow their bliss down that rabbit hole, quote unquote. And at the end of that journey, they're playing at Carnegie Hall, right? And they are one of the world's elite cellists. But don't ask them a thing about math. Don't ask them a thing about biology. Don't even ask them to speak proper English. Put a cello in their hands and say, Beethoven, go.
Charlene is chomping at the bit. I am here for it.
Right? And they say, Beethoven, yeah, go. Answer. And they go. Yeah. Is that a bad thing?
No, I hear you. I hear you. Here's the problem. Our society has not caught up with that style of learning. We have not acknowledged that we live now in a globalized society where you don't necessarily need to have a high level of expertise in all these areas. So what we deemed to be very important, where you have to have this subject to graduate high school, the relevance of those subjects now, like, at what point do the powers that be say, hey, we're going to actually revamp what we think are the requirements? Because this is now literally everywhere in the world. And Sir Kenneth Robinson does an amazing TED Talk on this. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's the topic of it is, do schools kill creativity?
And you know what? I did
see. Yeah, and he talks about the girl who's a dancer, right? And how, well, you know, she's not a problem. You just need to let her dance, right? Yes. And so, inherently, no, tunnel vision is not a problem. But in the current society in which we live, where you need your BGCSE and BJC to get this job, etc. Like, I've heard horror stories of people who have come back to the country with an MBA and have been denied jobs because they didn't have their BJC or their BGCSE. But they now have an MBA.
Well, I don't know that I disagree, but I do have a concern, right? Which is an amazing cellist who does not understand World War II, I think is not as amazing a cellist as they could be. And I think the world is less for that. I'm not sure if I'm expressing...
No, I understand exactly what you mean. Let's take... it's amazing that you said that. There are a couple of pieces written for the cello. One of them is called Threnody. And it's about... It is a composer's response to the experience of a particular group of people during the Holocaust. And the cellist who is playing it can't just play the notes. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not about the notes.
They have to feel it.
They have to understand. Mm-hmm. They have to, in order to actually feel what that piece is trying to say, they have to have some sense of history. They have to have some sense of empathy for the people and the composer and all of that. So yes, the cellist without history is less of a cellist than they would be with the history. You're right, 150%. But I think you are... I don't know that I'm changing what I was going to say, right? Because what I was going to say is I think you're making my point. But I don't know that I actually have a point per se. It's a conversation. I'm not. It's, this time it's not an argument, man. But what you are saying is, to me, enriching what I'm saying, right? Because
right,
but Yo-Yo Ma, for instance, as a cellist, is a phenomenal. The world knows this man's name. He's also very widely read, not because it is required for him to be a human being, but because he's interested in it. Because he found that the more he read about different things, the more he experienced life in all of its fullness, that enriched his experience both as a cellist and as a human being. Mm-hmm. And so I think that you can have the tea, you know, the broad and then very deep on one or two things, but that's not a bad thing. The question is that I wrote for myself is, must you be well-rounded? I mean, that was what education was all about, right? The whole peregrination that you had to take in the Middle Ages and those, when you, to be an educated person, it wasn't just that you knew a subject. It was that you had experience of the world, right? And so we have this sense that in order to, quote-unquote, be educated, you have to be well-rounded. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm asking, am I pushing back? Am I challenging that? Or am I just,
I don't know.
Pointing?
This is a question
am I pointing that question to Charlene? Yeah?
In that, do you think that if people just follow their bliss, that they naturally shut them off from other things? Or do you see that help blossom an interest or other interests that they have? Like is there a...
For me, in an ideal world, I guess, we would have better family structure where parents are more involved in their children's lives from the early years, have more time.
Shots
and that they
fired.
I'm not firing shots at anyone in particular, but I mean, right now the reality is if you have a two-parent home, both of those parents are likely working. But by and large, we have more and more single-parent households raising children. There's not enough societal support to truly have parents engaging with their children in the ways that they should. Mm-hmm. So what we have is institutionalized learning from now age 2, 3, 4, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for those schools to function, they need to have a certain sense of discipline and structure and everybody learning the same thing all at once, because the system just isn't designed to be fluid, and it would cost, you know, from a government standpoint, for the government schools to change to a much more fluid Montessori model or something, the cost would be astronomical, yeah, right? And then more to the point, society, we have a very fixed mindset about what education looks like. Must wear a uniform, must do this, that, and the other thing. Yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. It's a very, you know, we have that structured system in our minds, right? Mm. So even when you have a school like mine that children don't wear uniforms, that really throws some people for a loop. Like, wait, they're not wearing uniforms? Like, doesn't that distract them? Doesn't that? No, actually, they learn just fine, even without the uniform, right? Mm-hmm. But let me not get away from the point. If we, in a perfect world, could spend more time building kids up early with the curiosity, with the actual soft skills of just engagement in what they're learning, and that natural creativity. If we could build that early, then kids would go out and want to learn about a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. So it would have to be a systemic change for us to truly change education for what it should be moving forward. Because once you can read, once you can write, and you can, you know, at a certain point, like maybe an eighth grade level, because let's face it, newspapers are pretty much written at an eighth grade level.
Right.
That at one point was the basic of what you needed to have if you then wanted to be, you know, go off into the world, right? So if we could make sure everybody was literate, everybody had basic consumer math skills, and then you go off and explore what you choose to, I think we could actually see a cultural revolution. But do I see that happening anytime soon? Hard to say.
Hard to say, but better than no.
But right now, AI is basically coming for everybody's job, so including mine. I mean, so we will see.
Matthew likes that, though. I
like the capabilities of AI, right? Mm-hmm. And there is a potential there that is, I would say, even beyond the Star Trek universe of the Federation, right? The problem is that in our current system, market forces dictate too much, and an AI may replace you, but it doesn't mean that they are a better educator. It just means that the market put you out of a job because whatever was being optimized for just ate up everything else. And that's not necessarily a good thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It means that markets tend to be quite efficient. They tend to be quite bad at determining what we should be efficient at.
There's a reason I teach dystopian novels in my school.
Yeah, but which is also a double-edged sword, because there's been some pushback as to like how much dystopian sci-fi, especially, has contributed to a bleak outlook as opposed to, you know, a more positive. These things are self-fulfilling to an extent, right? And so I think we need more solarpunk in the world. Mm-hmm. Without saying that we need to get rid of teaching the dystopian stuff, I think it's not Dick. It's he's going to come to me in a second. But Titan in sci-fi, who said he writes this stuff as a warning, like this is what could happen.
Not Asimov.
No.
Roth.
Wasn't Asimov.
Philip Roth.
I'll put it in the show notes.
All right. Fair enough. Good enough. So we live in strange times. Every time I'm sure is considered strange times by the people who live in it, right? Hold on a second. Do you taste the candy now? Or are you still just stuck on the smoke?
I mean, if you speak of licorice as candy, then yes, I taste the candy.
Then why, if it's licorice, why are you continuing to drink that?
Who told you I didn't like licorice?
I hate licorice. Oh, I do. Okay. All of that being said, you have still embarked on the journey of trying to offer, and not trying, succeeding in offering education as a product to hopefully a willing and rabid buyer's market, right? You started a business. You are offering education as your product. What have you found from the perspective of the business side of the game? Is education, I know it's profitable. You were at Windsor for a while. You were at Meridian for a while. You were at Tamberley for a while. These are sort of the new vanguard of modern education in the Bahamas, and Boost is right there with them, right? So it's clearly a profitable enterprise. But talk to us about education as a business in the context of everything that we've been talking about.
Well, it's intended to be profitable, I suppose. We probably entered into things at the wrong time because we were, in the COVID mix when, everything went kind of belly up for a while and most businesses just barely scraped by. Education was not exempt from that.
Yeah. James Snowbacky's 1, 2, 3.
but ultimately, the goal with our school, because people have said, well, is it a nonprofit or whatnot? And we have talked about making it a nonprofit before because it might as well be, because everything that we make goes back into the school. But it's actually, in some respects, easier just to keep it as a standard business than to have the extra loopholes of the nonprofit, to be honest. Sure. But really, by and large, we're trying to create the school we want for our own children. So I have 2 daughters, almost 2 and 4. And so by the time that they're in grades 4 through 12, the goal is, hey, we have them with us at the school. We have more of a say. I know I probably wouldn't end up being at a point where I'm homeschooling my own children only, exclusively, but I think it'll be nice to have them close to me and have a say in their education. So that's kind of the broader goal for me. I also, altruism is kind of one of the things that's always in the back of my mind, but I also need to eat. So clearly, having a school does open up opportunities for you to give back as well. So the goal is, again, to hopefully be able to provide scholarships and do more community work down the road as well. So certainly I don't see it as how you mentioned, some people are in it for the money. Mm-hmm. And in fairness, I have been accused of that before. But then I'm like, y'all don't see the car I drive.
I've been holding my tongue.
If I was in it for the money, I would have chosen a different career path.
I'm sure that the cutthroat people could make it very profitable. But I've been holding my tongue. Quincy's assertion that it is very profitable.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, for sure. Like, if you don't put anything back into the business, if you buy books in 1972 and then never, never actually upgrade anything, or, there are ways that you can make it profitable. But
one of those ways is by, as every parent of a particular school will tell you, by inventing new fees and charges almost on a bi-weekly basis.
Shots fired.
If shots were fired, I would call the name of the school. I'm not good at.
I think you said as everyone would know. So.
Yeah.
But I mean that's, and I've seen that aspect of schools run as a business as well. You know, a child who's in. Okay, I'm teaching this child every day. This child is failing, and then I'm going to charge you $75 an hour for tutoring after school so that you can pass the class in which I'm already teaching you.
Yes.
So again, when I started this academy, I said, like, there's no way I would feel comfortable charging for that. So we've made it all inclusive.
This underscores my point about markets.
Right? Yes.
Like, so you have to be careful.
So this is the thing. We basically said, you know, if we're responsible for your child's education, we're going to do everything it takes to make sure that they're successful in our program.
Right.
So we would provide the additional tutoring. We would provide the additional classes at no additional cost so that we can actually, you know, make sure that we're delivering on our promise. Mm-hmm. So that's really the goal. So again, if I was in it for the profit, I would probably include extra charges for those classes, extra charges for tutoring, extra, you know, school opens at 7:30. I know some schools charge for early drop-off.
For sure.
You know, we just supervise from 7:30 till 5, you know, and there's no extra cost. So there's that. But
it is, as you say, altruism is one thing. Mm-hmm. But you have to stay in business, right?
Yes.
In order to provide the service that your wonderful altruistic goals tell you that it's your duty as a human being to provide. Mm-hmm. What is a boutique school?
A fancy name for small. So basically we have about 60 students. So it's just a niche. It's a small school. It was part of our marketing branding from the get-go, so it's just kind of stuck with me.
It's very clear.
So how many teachers are there?
So we've always maintained at least an 8-to-1 student to staff ratio.
8-to-1.
Yes. So
wow.
Don't rush past that. I want Matthew to elaborate on his wow just now.
I mean, it is. It wasn't uncommon even 20 years ago for
3 years ago. I know a school.
Currently, there are some schools. There are some private schools that have 38 kids in one class.
Yes.
So right.
20 years
for
is too
one
long.
Teacher.
And right. That's no, sometimes I'm saying if it was grades. 20 years ago, it's got to be worse now.
Yeah.
There are easily 30 kids to a class.
Fair enough.
Right?
My bad.
Now, I was lucky in a lot of respects in the public education system. I went to Harbor Island All Age until grade 9. And you need a teacher per subject for the most part for a lot of the subjects, right? But because at the time there were 300 kids from grade 1 through grade 11, this is just before grade 12 became a BGCSE, mandate. By the time my brother graduated that school, and then he went on to a private school here because he was 2 years ahead anyway, so there were only 4 people in that graduating class. So because there was a fairly high attrition rate of maybe that's a little harsh saying attrition.
No, that's the right
for kids
that's
dropping
the right
out
word.
Of school.
Yeah.
But because so few children were at the upper levels, I saw what a much better student-to-teacher ratio could do. But at the same time, I saw, 20-plus kids in the lower grades. Not that they were getting a terrible education, but I saw the contrast there. So I know firsthand what a better student-teacher ratio could be. And then if you have good teachers on top of that, teachers who are cultivating relationships, like you said, right? and teachers are people, they're complicated beings. You know, they could be great to one student and not so great to another.
Let me tell you.
You know, so
let me tell you.
I don't want to make you all out to be angels, even though many of you are.
That,
The ratio is huge.
The first person, speaking of angels, the first person who was outside of my family for whom I shed tears was Adrian Julian Fowkes. Fowkes was my... I love that man. I still do. But when he left QC the first time, I was in the sixth grade, and I think he went to St. Andrews or whatever. And when he told me he was leaving, he knew that it was going to be bad. So he kind of pulled me on the side. He was like, all right, so Quincy, I'm leaving. I won't be back next year. And I wept for a week because I loved Mr. Fox. And when he came back to QC, I had been kind of half-stepping. I almost said half-assing. Half-stepping my French classes. And he took over for Miss Nenadich to teach French for us. And all of a sudden, I loved French again because Fauci was there, right? He taught us French drinking songs and all kinds of absolute foolishness. On the other side, speaking of devils, there was a physics teacher who is now known more as a sort of a play a guitar and a little duo kind of thing, who was known for his temper. And I remember one class, the man threw a capacitor at my head.
Oh my!
And if I had not actually seen him throw it, so that I could move my head out of the way, he would have hit me in my head with a capacitor that he flung at as hard as he could. Right.
Right. I think it's very important to know what kind of capacitor this was.
it was
a huge.
Yeah, it was like this big. Big as my hand.
You would call it. Okay. Yeah. That's condenser territory. All right.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It was like, and it was heavy, you know? I don't know. I can't remember what he was trying to teach. And I don't know why he was so angry because everybody was talking. But apparently it was just my day. Because I've heard stories from other students about him.
Wow.
After, you know,
he sounds very
story.
Similar to a history teacher that I know.
Yeah. So you're right about the extremes that teachers can go to. I don't mind calling Fox's name, but I don't want to call the other guy's name.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever. But 8-to-1 is a great ratio. It's phenomenal. But is it sustainable? I mean, can you make a business out of 8-to-1?
If you're not in it for the money, yes. Yes. And that's the thing. Like, the goal is literally just to put into the school, make it a great place to be. I spend my days there. I'm there 7:30 to 5 every day, and then sometimes on the weekends. So I might as well make it the place that I love to be as well. And again, that's where my kids will be. That's where hopefully my kids' friends will be. That's, you know, I envision it as kind of an extension of my home in a way, you know? So, and my students go on to become like family. You know, to this day, students I've taught in, you know, 15 years ago in seventh grade, now they're upstanding members of the community doing various things. And so I always make a point of supporting my former students' businesses or trying to involve them in projects or bring them in as speakers and, and things like that. Because to me, I guess because I grew up in a small town, it's all about just building your own community. Okay. So when I think about teaching my students, I don't see them as just, okay, you're passing through my doors and that's it. Like, I literally want to build them up to become my own kids' future teachers or future doctors, lawyers, game developers, musicians, all of these things, you know? So I guess I just, that's the vision behind it.
Just out of curiosity, naughty alert, you said many of your students are upstanding members of community. Mm. Do you have any former students who are not upstanding members of your community? Who are criminals or degenerates or...
To the best of my knowledge, no. Mm-hmm. To the best of my knowledge, no. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean...
But you can't vouch for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, yeah. Ultimately, I mean, there are some kids who, you know, we will try to help every child who comes through the doors. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you will find that parents are not always on board with what they need to do to mm-hmm. help them. So you can advise and you can do what you can during school hours. But if, you know, if the parents are not enforcing what they need to at home and following through and mostly setting boundaries, actually just basic boundaries at home and saying no to things, then there's not much that we can do. But fortunately, at this point in time, I'm not aware of any degenerate students. No.
Boundaries.
That could be a whole separate podcast.
She said the word no. The parents must say no to things. I just want to underline that parents must say no to things. You know what? I'm going to underline it again. No. So what it does for me, it brings me full circle-ish to Matthew's first question, which was asked in a typically Matthewine or Matthew-ish type of way. That I would like... What? What is that face?
I'm listening.
Oh, okay. Well, I would like to reinterpret Matthew's question my own way and ask... What, in your view, education should result in?
That's a great question as well. No shade at your initial question. I just saw him react there like, yeah, I'm hurt.
No, none taken. I don't.
But to me, education ultimately should result in happy individuals. Like, they're happy people who go on to live productive lives and give back to their communities. I'm not hoping to churn out a bunch of Elon Musks. I'm not hoping to, you know, if
I should,
if not. You know,
shots but continue if I, to be fired.
I want people to be innovative and successful, yeah. certainly, but mm-hmm. I just want people to be able to go on in their lives and just live happy, fulfilling lives and do what makes them feel good. And we all know what makes us feel good, and that's usually in tandem with what helps other people as well. So, yeah, I guess that might sound really cheesy, but...
Oh, no, cheesy. I do wish... I really want to flesh this out. So I think that in addition to inviting you back, which is a no-brainer, I wanted to float the idea and get Quincy's approval of once we have had a few more of these conversations, which we've been planning with other educators as well, if you would be so kind as to join more of a roundtable discussion in the future.
Absolutely.
On education.
For sure. Mm-hmm. You know, I was actually thinking, given that people, for whatever reason, are enjoying what we're doing, we should probably, you know, like maybe do a thing here, like a live panel type situation, and record it as part of, as well.
Here being the wonderful Crypto Isle.
Here being the wonderful mm-hmm. Crypto Isle, yeah.
Of course.
Would you join us on such a thing?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, that's a commitment. So okay, so happy individuals who live productive lives. I wrote down the word altruism because you say give back to their society or community, whatever the case may be. But you didn't say rich.
No. I personally, I do not think you have to be rich to be happy. You need to be comfortable. You need to have your needs met. You need to be able to have, you know, a certain lifestyle that you choose. But I don't think, while they, you know, money doesn't buy happiness, it does to an extent, but there's a cap. I don't think somebody who's a millionaire is less happy than somebody who's a billionaire or vice versa.
It's what about somebody who's a thousandaire?
A thousandaire, I think it depends. Mm-hmm. Do you have health insurance? Do you have the ability to, you know, if your car breaks down, that you are not going to be stranded? You know, do you have your own home? Certain things like that. I think there's a certain level of wealth that you would want to strive toward. But for me, that has never actually been something on my radar. I want to be comfortable, but not.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to disagree with that at all. I simply want to call back that the culture around parents not only put making boundaries, but also having the home culture of maintaining curiosity and, you know, just a wide variety of experience for the child. Both of you said that both of those things are hard. Mm-hmm. So if they're hard, well, good luck with this.
Yeah, because, for sure.
Bahamians want their children to be rich.
They do. They certainly do.
Well,
mainly, I mean, there's a part of that is a selfish motive too, because my rich child is going to take care of me when I don't have to work anymore. And I know Maya Camille, I hope you're listening. That's my daughter. but I want to. Matthew has a phrase in my head, damn him, callback. Something that you said just a few minutes ago about the synergy between doing what you love and help, and somehow that working for other people as well, right?
The Japanese concept called the ikigai. That's not what you were going to say, was it?
No. I love the concept.
Yeah. But, familiar with ikigai?
Okay, yeah. Yeah,
I know you're familiar, Matt.
All the overlapping Venn diagrams.
It's a guest who's quoting one of our thingies that excited me.
I know. But
so why are you chastising me?
To give you a boundary.
Yes, daddy.
Oh, boy.
Please continue.
The show is just...
Yeah. So, ikigai.
Yes. You were saying.
Oh, well, I think I cut you off. Sorry.
No, you didn't.
Okay. But yeah, basically...
I was jumping in to say...
Just because wealth is not like my number one thing that I'm after doesn't mean I'm not happy to attain it. If that's one of their priorities and they want to find a job that they love and can make them wealthy, I'm not going to cut them off from that either. Mm-hmm. So not to say that coming to my school, I'm going to be telling them, no, don't get rich. So don't worry about that. I would certainly encourage them to follow their passion and make money, for sure.
And that clarification, I'm sure, is
quite... But I just...
I would extra encourage that, because the types of people that you seek to churn out are something that I'm totally behind. And the more influence they have in society, the happier I will be.
Yeah. And... I'm hoping that we can really capitalize actually on upcoming blockchain development and get our kids into that stream of things as well, because I think as we unveil our blockchain program and kind of work with more of our emerging technologies programming that's coming on stream, I think that'll open up a lot of great opportunities for our graduates as well. So that's, yeah. So
see, this is a plethora of shows that you need to be invited back for.
And I think she dropped that during the last 5 minutes with knowledge. That was very deliberate and very well played.
You can't say she's not skilled.
Yes, oh, boy. Very well played.
Oh, boy.
Matthew and I were having an argument, debate, conversation, chat on the way in today about... it's kind of a continuation of the question of calling that we were talking about with Rhea on a recent podcast episode. And it sounds to me like you are saying that that there is a, that having such a focus on what you love to do is sort of the way to go in terms of trying to find whatever professional endeavor you're going to attempt to make your life. And I wanted to ask you, I think that'll probably end up being our last point, so I wanted to ask you to speak to that.
I worked for Canada Border Services. I was a Border Services officer, so customs officer. And I could have, had I have stuck with it, I probably would have been rolling in money at this point because it was a stable federal government job. I rolled into it as a summer student, and then I was brought on for a term position. And in the time I spent there, it was great because it was good money to help me pay through my way through school and things like that, right? But I watched the misery around me of federal government workers who were in a job that they didn't like. And they would spend 12 hours a day there because we did shift work. So 12 hours doing something you hated. And you could see the toll that it took on them. And then because they didn't like it and they were horrible to other people around them, it brought everybody down. And it created a horrible culture in which to work. There were some great people, yes. But depending on who you're on shift with, it made a big difference. And I was offered a full-time position, which meant I would have had an amazing offer coming straight out of university. And my friends who stuck with it, I mean, they all have like multiple properties, like brand new cars, all this stuff, right? They're doing well for themselves. But I had to decline the offer. My dad almost like disowned me at the time. You turned down what? To go backpacking in South America? What? But I did. I call it my quarter life crisis. I just had to say, I know this is not what I want. And I had to walk away. And I literally went backpacking in South America for 3 months and kind of regrouped. But upon that journey of self-discovery, I realized, you know, being happy at what you do is ultimately the best thing you can do for yourself, because it doesn't matter if you make tons of money if the majority of your time is spent doing something you hate.
Yeah.
So I picked a job that I actually enjoy going to. And I tell my students this all the time. Even if I were so rich that I didn't have to work, I would still choose to do this. So yeah, if it's something you would choose to do, even if you didn't need the money, then it's, you know, it's, yeah. I'm not quite living the dream, because it's a lot of work. I would love to be able to step away a lot. I would love to be able to step away, like, so that I don't need to be there every single day in that capacity. But ultimately, I'm doing what I want to do.
With that, I very much look forward to having you back, Charlene.
Yes, absolutely.
It has been a joy, a great conversation.
Charlene Hansen, Boost Academy, is lucky to have you. We were lucky to have you for this conversation. You will probably be getting phone calls from Matthew and myself about some of the things that you said today to be hijacked and woven into other areas, because neither one of us lets good resources go, and it's very clear you're a good resource. So just brace yourself for that. But all of that being said, thank you so much for joining us today on the Sunday Scotch Society. You were, I think, Matthew's find, so to speak. So I want to congratulate him on bringing a diamond into the studio. So thank you, Matthew, for bringing Charlene to us.
I just meet people who are interested. That's it.
Yeah, sure. Way to downplay it. You asked her and she said yes. Take your win, brother. Thank you.
Yeah.